Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. The days here in Kentucky are getting shorter, darker, grayer, colder. While there's a lot to look forward to in winter, it's not necessarily the most wonderful time of the year for everybody. Some or all of what we're about to discuss may ring a bell with you. Dr. Matt Southward is a research assistant professor in the University of Kentucky College of Psychology, and he's with us. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
So many of us fall into something of a funk, maybe a day or two of sadness here and there once the holidays are over. Is there anything to be concerned about?
There is only something to be concerned about when that funk lasts, really, or gets in the way of things for you. So, seasonal depression, seasonal affective disorder, it's really a subtype of a major depressive disorder. And that condition is characterized by at least 2 weeks in a row of feeling that kind of really down, depressed, or blue, or just finding yourself like not having the same interest in stuff that you normally do, as well as other things like fatigue or overeating or oversleeping, things like that.
And that's if that goes on for a little bit, right? For a couple of
weeks. Yeah. So if you have that for a couple weeks in a row, it's really getting in the way of stuff that you really care about doing. That's when it starts to reach that clinical level.
And does season-related depression, does that happen mostly in fall and winter, or can it happen in other times of the year?
It often happens in fall and winter, but it doesn't have to. There's many people for whom seasonal depression actually happens in the spring or summer. And so it's something where if you have it the same time each year for a couple years in a row, and it's not due to just the normal stressors that you're experiencing, like holidays picking up, for instance, or losing a job the same time of year for a couple years in a row, but you're just noticing, yep, I'm feeling more down or depressed at this time of year and not at other times, then that could be a good indication that that's a seasonal version of it.
You mentioned behaviors that might be signals. Are there other symptoms that we might want to be on the watch for?
Yeah. So, oftentimes you've got feeling down, depressed, or blue, feeling a lack of interest in things. With seasonal depression, it's a lot more of this kind of oversleeping, overeating, or craving carbohydrates, feeling a lack of energy or fatigue, on top of other conditions that are pretty standard with depression, things like feeling more guilty than normal, just not having the same level of energy or interest in things.
Is there a demographic group that's more susceptible to seasonal affective disorder than others?
It kind of parallels regular depression, where women tend to experience depression and seasonal depression more often than men. We'll see seasonal depression a little more often in younger folks. And then here in the Northern Hemisphere, if you live farther and farther north, you may be more apt to experience seasonal depression here in the fall and winter, as you said in the intro, as the days get shorter and temperatures drop. So those are some folks who may be a little bit more at risk for this kind of condition.
I'm really curious about that, though. Is it understood why women and younger people are more susceptible?
I don't know that there are great reasons. So for depression broadly, there are many aspects to this. So we find that women often start to experience depression more often around puberty. And so there's all the changes that happen both biologically, but also socially, that women are exposed to more stressors starting in puberty. And so we think that combined with kind of this like ruminative thought process may be contributing to why women in general tend to experience higher rates of depression than men. And then as for, younger folks versus older folks, there's kind of an ebb and flow to that in general, where, there's maybe more stressors as we're coming into adolescence. In young adulthood, things start to even out a little bit. But then as we get farther along in life, we may accomplish more things. Our bodies may start to break down on us. And so then that depression starts to go up again. So it is this real ebb and flow. But there's a lot less research on seasonal variants of this to understand exactly, what is it that causes people to have it depression only in these particular times of year?
I've read that the decreased sunlight in winter can result in decreases in our levels of serotonin and vitamin D, increases in melatonin. First, is that correct? And if it is, why are those factors important to be aware of?
Yes. So my understanding is those are good. Those are sound facts to rely on. And those are all neurotransmitters involved in kind of maintaining our well-being. So, you know, we've kind of gotten away from like one chemical being kind of the be-all or end-all of our, you know, psychological well-being. But serotonin, of course, is involved in so many processes of modulating our emotions, of helping us respond to stressors. And so, you know, when that kind of, when we don't have the same levels of that kind of neurotransmitter, we might start to be more susceptible to emotional kind of ebbs and flows or spikes.
I understand that the decrease in sunshine in winter is thought to disrupt the circadian rhythm, the 24-hour internal clock that we have. Does light therapy help with that?
There's been some cool research that it does. So it, you know, this is something where you might want to, you would want to check with your doctor first to see what kind of light exposure you want. And it's not just, you know, turning the lights on in your house or your apartment, but it actually is a concentrated high dose of light in the morning to try to mirror what we would get from the sun during summertime or when days are a little bit longer. So, you know, there's some good research that light therapy, by looking at light, by having that kind of like in your eyes, in your face, early in the morning, especially when you're waking up, can be a way to start to combat this, you know, this lack of vitamin D or these lack of neurotransmitters and chemicals that we might otherwise be getting other times of year.
Are there other things we can do on our own to kind of help lift ourselves out of the winter blues?
So many things. So on top of that, I mean, again, with this being a variant of major depression, this condition responds really well to especially cognitive behavior therapy. So there are cognitive skills we can do, like just taking a breath, taking a step back, evaluating the evidence for our thoughts. So when we have thoughts that, you know, we're not doing well, or we're falling behind, or we're not meeting expectations, really taking a step back and seeing, is that true? What evidence do we have for that? But also behavioral things. So I know it's cold. I know it's hard to get outside. Taking advantage when we do have better days to be outside, or just making it a point to get more movement around our homes or around our workplaces or somewhere inside, so that we just physically are moving more than we otherwise might want to. And being social too, right? So accepting social invitations, extending social invitations, even when we don't feel like it, can be a really great way to maintain those kind of connections and bonds, even when we are, you know, more secluded or want to hunker down.
Kind of bring us out of our burrows, right?
That's it.
Well, I really appreciate it. Dr. Matt Southward from the University of Kentucky College of Psychology. Thank you so much for joining us, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
I'm sure that you'll forgive me if I don't enthuse. I guess I got the Christmas blues.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
It was a busy, 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 very, very busy time of year.
If straight off from the full-time job of managing and executing the family Thanksgiving gathering, you're now about to do it all over again for whatever you celebrate with family and friends at this time of year, and you're already exhausted just thinking about it, well, you're hardly alone. The good news is there are strategies you can put to work to avoid struggling through this season. Michelle Martell has written about this, a clinical psychologist. She is chair of psychology at the University of Kentucky, where she studies disruptive behavior and attention deficit hyperactive disorders. She's here to help. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Martell.
Hi. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So what would you say are the more common sources of anxiety and that exhaustion that I mentioned this time of year?
I think people tend to put a lot on themselves around the holidays. There's this idea, perhaps particularly if you have kids, but even if you don't, that, you know, things need to be really bright and jolly. And I don't know about everyone else, but in our family, there's always a sense like there could be one more dish, you know, one more type of food that you could be making for that holiday dinner, that there's one more group of people you need to invite over, that there's just one more gift you need to buy for someone special. And I think people tend to put a lot of pressure on themselves to make sure everything is not just going well, but is the best and is going perfectly. Everybody's having a great time. So I think that can tend to keep us more busy than is healthy and can cause a lot of stress with those potentially unmet expectations.
Well, all that sounds very familiar. And I mentioned that you published an article about all this. And the first bit of advice that you offer is to stick to a routine or be intentional about breaking that routine. Tell us about that.
You know, the holidays are a time when people often are traveling or maybe overindulging or doing different activities. Perhaps the kids are staying up a little later to do things like go see lights or go to festivals. And that can compound stress because it can make people cranky. It can cause a lot of tension between family members. And it can put just kind of throw people off so they're not feeling their best at a time of year that does tend to be somewhat stressful. So I always tell people, try to stick to a routine as much as possible. Obviously, there will be times when you have to break it, traveling, special activities, things like that. But try to keep those to a minimum and try to figure out ways to kind of make up on rest or downtime or things like that, because we still need sleep. We still need to be getting all of the basic food groups. And if you don't, you will be paying the price.
Now, here's a big one. Adults often forget to prioritize ourselves. Why is that important, not just to ourselves, but to everybody else in our family? And how should we go about doing that?
Yeah, I mean, as a mom, as well as a child clinical psychologist working with families, I see this all the time. It's very easy to stay focused on other people's needs and wants over the holiday season. But adults, especially parents or caregivers, tend to set the tone for everyone else. So if you're really stressed and run down, that is going to make it hard for everyone, including the rest of your family. Sometimes the best gift you can give people is taking a little bit of time for yourself to make sure that you stay in the holiday spirit, that you're feeling rested and ready to tackle everything. When you're feeling under the weather or just tired yourself, then that can have a negative impact on everybody else because you're feeling out of sorts already.
Well, here's a good one. You note that often the things that stress adults the most are the things that are least important to everybody else in the family, including the kids. What are you getting at there?
I used to spend a lot of time making the holiday meals, you know, had to, you know, oh, we need to have a few different types of pie. We need to have extra vegetables. And honestly, all the extra time I would spend really didn't matter to the kids at all. I mean, the kids probably would have been happy if I just picked up the whipped cream that I buy to go with the pies rather than spend all that time making pies, especially, you know, making them from scratch. They really could care less about that. They don't really care about the extra vegetables. One of the best things we did for our family was going to a system where my husband would do the cooking for the holiday meal, and he would make very simple things like chocolate chip waffles with whipped cream and bacon for like the brunch. Honestly, I think the kids were happier with that than the, you know, like 5-course meal I was making, salad and bread and ham and turkey and vegetables and pie. And, you know, I really think that they preferred the easy, fast stuff that my husband did. And it really has been win-win for everyone because it cuts down on my stress and on the multitasking I'm doing. You know, perhaps so I can focus a little bit on myself, maybe get a little bit of extra time with my coffee in the morning or things like that, which, you know, ends up leaving everybody in a better mood.
Sounds like we just need to chill out a little bit generally, huh? A big source of anxiety around this time of year is it can be so expensive. We want or we think we have to do nice things for all of our loved ones, but really can't afford a lot of holiday magic. Michelle, can you give us permission to step back from that a little bit?
One of my self-mottos for the holidays is less is more, both in terms of some of the things I was talking about before, in terms of all the cooking and meals and visits, but also just in terms of the holiday wish list for the kids. I've tried to incorporate in our house going out and doing stuff for other people. So going to visit a nursing home or giving back in some way as part of our holiday tradition. And I also encourage the kids and all of us really to think about doing thoughtful things for each other if it's just a card. You know, the kids will often like make cards for us instead of going out shopping for us. And, you know, obviously we do still try to buy some gifts. I don't want to necessarily deprive my kids or anything, but if we can do as one of the gifts, some quality time doing something or getting away somewhere, even if it's after the holidays, we try to incorporate things like that to make it a little bit less focused on the stuff sometimes I think kids can get a little oversaturated with the amount we buy them. And then I find myself stressed out about having to clean everything out over the holidays to make room. Sometimes I think it's more meaningful to have fewer things that are more meaningful and special, even if it's things like a handmade card.
Well, in our family, and I have to imagine this is going on in other households, the Christmas list conundrum. Some of us are moving away from that. We kind of feel like we're being handed an order, that an order is being placed. Here's what we want you to buy us. And it just doesn't feel at all in the spirit of the season. What are your thoughts about kids and Christmas lists?
I do think that having a little bit more focus on experiences or time together, doing things for each other or for other people, as opposed to just lots of gifts and lots of material things, is probably going to be better bang for your buck. And I also think as a parent and as a child clinical psychologist, it's good modeling, right? Like that's what I hope my kids go out and do later, is they remember to give back to family and friends and the broader community at this time of year.
Well, you know, even before Halloween, you can go into a big box store and right beside the huge Halloween display, there's a big Christmas display before Halloween. The retail push where their agenda seems to become our agenda can really deflate some of the joy of the season. How can we set boundaries and protect that joy?
I think we're inundated with a lot of messages about needing to buy more stuff. And I personally think it ratchets up my stress level. Did I get enough? Did I buy my child enough things? Like, do I need to buy the new fancy toy that is being advertised? Now that she's seen that, is she going to ask for that? So yeah, I think being a little strategic about what you're exposed to, both in terms of screens and social media and TV, and also in terms of the stores you visit and the kinds of things that your kids are seeing and being exposed to can be really helpful around this time of year.
Well, our household, again, has really come around to this last bit of advice that you offer in your article. We tried it over Thanksgiving, and by and large, it made a big difference in how much we all enjoyed being together and having a holiday together. And that is, ask for help in the kitchen, setting the table, keeping the tribe entertained while the magic's happening in that kitchen. Everybody should pitch in. What's getting in the way of that?
I think that's great what you're doing. I always encourage our kids to either help with the cooking or help with the cleanup if they don't help with the cooking, or help setting out things or helping each other wrap or make cards or make presents or make decorations. There's, you know, depending on the age of the child, there's plenty of ways to help, as well as, like I said, we try to do some like kind of community outreach or giving at this time of year too. But I also want to point out that the holidays can be a really tough time for people, not just in terms of perhaps the more mundane types of stress, just, you know, all the to-do lists and all the things you feel like you need to do and the people you need to visit and people that you need to take care of perhaps. And I always remind people that this is a great, good time of year, not only to ask for support from family, like me asking my husband to help out with some of the cooking perhaps, but it's also a good time of year to feel free to reach out for professional help, because in addition to exacerbations and some of these clinical problems like depression and anxiety, this time of year can also sometimes be challenging for people who have lost loved ones or people who have family tensions. And so I think it can be really helpful to have professional support and backup at what can be a really difficult time of year.
That's clinical psychologist Michelle Martell, chair of psychology at the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Low-cost therapy clinics are available at universities in the area. Here at Eastern, we have the EKU Psychology Clinic with sessions conducted by advanced graduate students and supervised by licensed faculty. And at UK, there's the Harris Center Psychology Clinic. Sessions there are conducted by advanced grad students and supervised by licensed faculty. The cost of a session at these clinics is income-based and ranges from $5 to $50. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. The Carnegie in Covington will present the Cincinnati Sound Chorus's Yuletide Celebration, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. Saturday, December 16th. The performances include featured guests Vivace and iTones. For information and to purchase tickets, visit thecarnegie.com. Woodford Theater in Versailles will present Miracle on 34th Street daily through December 17th. For information and to purchase tickets, visit woodfordtheater.com. And save the date, January 10th, to visit the state capitol in Frankfort for Arts Day in Kentucky. This special celebration is being presented by Kentuckians for the Arts. For more information on this event, visit kfta.wildapricot.org. For information on how to support these and other arts events in Kentucky, visit artscouncil.ky.gov.
Have you been thinking about bringing a dog or a cat into your life and prefer finding that companion at a shelter? Eastern Standard sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson found studio dog Ella Fitzgeraldine at the Lexington Humane Society. And I asked Megan Hawkins, director of community engagement at the shelter, to bring us up to speed on current trends and issues that they're seeing at the shelter on Old Frankfort Pike in Lexington. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Megan.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So bringing a dog or a cat into the home is a big consideration for a lot of people. Purebreds can have very specific traits and characteristics that we may be looking for to suit lifestyle and conditions, and we can research that and look it up and know going into buying a purebred or bringing a purebred home what we're getting into. Are rescue animals more of a wild card in that respect?
They can be, but we work hard to get to know them really well with their personality and behavior so that we can make the best recommendations for people based on their family, their lifestyle, exactly what they're looking for. So we try our best to find the right fit and be the matchmaker for families and people and dogs or cats.
How often or how frequently do adoptions fail to work out and the result is that the animals returned?
We're fortunate to say it's a very small percentage. We do over 4,000 adoptions a year, and I'd say maybe less than 5% of that would be animals who are returned. And we're lucky that we have resources and programs to work with them and to continue to take care of them and find them another home that hopefully works out for them.
Well, if adopting a new puppy was saving them, is returning that puppy dooming them? And I don't mean to dwell on the negative here, but I want to get it kind of out of the way before we get to the...
Oh, of course. And no, not at all. Again, we're very fortunate that we don't have any space limits or time limits or any certain number of times an animal can be adopted before it's X'd out or something. We will continue to place it up for adoption and find a home, albeit there's no health or behavior or aggression issue that would be barring it from finding a safe home.
Okay, I've been on your website. It's been some years since I've been to the Humane Society, and some new things are happening there, and I want to touch on one of them. What are Henry's Houses?
Oh, Henry's Houses are houses that were built actually at the start of pandemic. We wanted to debut them, I think it was March of 2020, thanks to the Marksberry families. And it's a chance for dogs to get out of this environment, out of the shelter environment, their loud cages, and go into a home-like environment and really get to de-stress and see what they're like on a rug, on a couch, and truly spend time with people, whether it's a potential adopter, a volunteer, or even just a staff member. It's a great chance to just give them a break from the shelter world and really get to know their personalities.
So these are actually little tiny houses that are furnished.
We have three little small houses, yeah, on the property. Each house has a fenced-in yard connected to it, so they have some exercise and some outdoor playtime. The houses have electricity, heat, AC, so they're fully equipped.
So it seems like a really great way to sense whether or not, you know, to spend some time with that dog or cat, I assume. Are cats also taken out to Henry's?
We have a separate area indoors for the cats.
Okay.
Yeah, we have a separate enclosed area. But yeah, it is a great chance to get to know the dog's personalities. And even if you're not looking to adopt, we encourage people, just anyone, whether you're a volunteer or not, to just take a dog out for a visit and get to spend time with it and just give it a chance to exercise and play. And then it goes back to the cage and it's well rested and it's not jumping and it's not barking. So people coming through to adopt, they'll see a different side of the dog.
And chances are really good if you've spent some time with a dog in the afternoon or whatever, that you're going to leave with a smile.
Yeah. And you know what we say, a tired dog is a happy dog. So people walk through and after a dog has been in Henry's Houses, they get to see a truly well-rested, happy dog.
Now, Megan, tell us about your foster care program. How does that work?
Our foster care program really has grown over the last few years due to the pandemic and people working remotely and being at home. We saw a huge increase in the number of people signed up to take care of the animals. Initially, the program was started just to take care of those who might be sick or too young to go up for adoption. All of our animals, they are vaccinated, they're altered, they're dewormed before they go up for adoption, but that can't happen until they're 2 pounds or 8 weeks, whichever comes first. So a lot of puppies and kittens that come in our doors, they could be 2 days old, 2 weeks old, a couple of weeks. So they'll need foster care until they're able to have surgery and then go up for adoption. So we have that aspect of fostering. If a dog comes in, it's been hit by a car and it maybe has to recover from a broken leg or have a leg amputated, it will require foster care until it fully heals from that surgery. If we have a dog or cat that came from, you know, an abusive or neglected environment and they're shy and they wouldn't do well right away in a cage, it gives them a chance to come out of their shell and get more comfortable. They would go into foster care beforehand, again, before going up for adoption. And something that we've opened up over the last couple of years is just due to the number of dogs, big dogs in our care available for adoption, we are now letting people foster them and promote them and market them and keep them in a home environment while also being available for adoption at the same time.
Does that foster home sometime become a forever home?
It does. And I'm glad you said forever home instead of a foster failure. We don't like to call it that because they have found a family. That happens a lot. People come in and they want to help keep a dog for a couple of weeks. And of course, as happens, they end up falling in love with them and keeping them for the rest of their lives.
Well, I'm wondering how the pandemic impacted the shelter and do any of those impacts linger today?
Well, initially, we just basically shut down all services except for those absolutely necessary to take care of the dogs and cats. I oversee our fundraising and event team, and we couldn't have any in-person events. We had to make a quick shift and pivot to virtual events. So that was a learning curve in itself. For foster care, like I said, that's when our foster care program really grew because we were calling on people to become foster parents and take our dogs from the shelter because we didn't have much staff to take care of them and move them to their houses and take care of them there. Our dog adoption numbers, they increased during the last couple of years. And then this last year, the dog number adoption numbers have gone down and cat adoption numbers have increased. We've seen a shift in that. In the past, we had no trouble adopting out dogs and puppies, and cats and kittens tended to stay longer. Over the last few years, I think as the pandemic has shifted and people are now back in the office and no longer working remotely, they like the independence of having cats. And I think that has been helped the increase in cat adoptions.
You know, that's so true. We got Millie, our cat, there at the shelter. And we love dogs. And I guess I'm speaking for those people you just mentioned. We love dogs a lot, but we also are away a lot. And cats
exactly.
are just more convenient, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm the same way. I mean, having worked here for almost 10 years, you can't help but have dogs and cats. That's just second nature. It comes with the job. I have dogs and cats, but if I go out of town, I specifically need to find someone to take care of the dogs.
Mm-hmm. Well, taking a look at your site again, there seems to be this large proportion of pit bull mixes. Is that an accurate read on my part? And if so, why is that? Are pit bull mixes difficult to place?
That's very accurate. And what we see in the shelter is usually indicative of what is popular with trends in culture. Several years ago, we had, or a couple decades, a lot of Dalmatians in care. Several years ago, we had a lot of Chihuahuas in care. And then over the last few years, the popularity of pit bulls has increased. And that means we see an increase in pit bulls in our care. It's just kind of, they go hand in hand. One of the reasons for that is housing regulations around Lexington. Whether it's landlords or apartment managers that won't allow pit bull mixes or pit bull breeds to live there. People who have had them at one point and they're having to rehome, they bring them to us, they surrender them, or they don't even go through that process. They just leave them as strays and put them out on the streets. And I would say we probably have at least 70% pit bull mixes available for adoption.
Now, we have touched on cats, and it'd be unfair of our cat friends out there if we didn't go a little bit more deeply into that. So tell us about Project Perfect.
And that's a program funded by Nancy T. Barron. And it's something that they started years ago when they were seeing so many stray cats. And the thing with cats is it's so hard to put a high adoption fee on them to adopt them because people can truly go to their backyard or go to Craigslist or Facebook and get a cat for free. So we knew that we'd have to put lower adoption fees on them. And there's also always the problem, not really a problem, but the area of feral cats and cat colonies. And we see a lot of those around the area. And these are cats that can continue to live on the streets and on their own, but we wanted to make sure that their population was controlled and to fix them. So we would trap them, alter them, whether it's spaying or neutering them, and then release them to go back to living where they were, while also knowing that the population wasn't continuing to increase with lots of unwanted kittens. 10 years ago, we were having tens of thousands of cats and kittens coming through our doors. And over the last couple of years, we've gotten that down to under 1,000. So there's been a huge increasing impact with that.
I see you have a program that takes what I would think shelter care to a whole new level. And I'm talking about Second Chances. Tell us about that one.
Second Chances is a program that we have to dip into a lot. I mentioned with foster care, there's sometimes these special cases that come in, whether it's a dog or cat from an abusive situation, and they have to have a life-altering surgery, or they have to have extensive care. Every animal that goes up for adoption, like I said, they're altered. So they already have that standard level of care before they go up for adoption. But then these other certain circumstances come in for a dog or a cat that has to have another type of surgery or this other type of care. And that's where the Second Chances program comes into play. So that's a money and a budget that we set aside for those. And that's, we're seeing that more frequently. We're seeing a lot of abusive and neglected animals coming into our care that need additional surgery, that need extended foster care, whether they need to go into a home and stay there for 6 to 8 weeks before they even go up for adoption. That's food and medicine and extra things that we have to continue to pay for before they even hit the adoption floor. So we're lucky that we have the Second Chances Fund to account for all of that and to take care of it.
Do you think when people are coming to the shelter, they should have some sort of an idea of what kind of mix they're looking for and know something about those breeds in that mix? For example, I spotted Bingo on your site. He's thought to be an Australian cattle dog / Jack Russell mix. So
yeah,
that's a ton of energy. That sure
is. I say it's 50-50. We want people to have an idea. We want people to know like their lifestyle. And, you know, are you very active? Are you a couch potato? Do you travel a lot? Do you have a big family? But then there's people that come in and they have this preset notion of exactly what they want, And then they stumble upon this cage and they fall in love with a dog that's the exact opposite of what they want. And it's usually just love at first sight. So it's hit or miss. You can come in with some sort of idea, but you can also partner with our adoption staff to help us find the right fit for you. And sometimes what you're looking for is not what you find. You find something even better that you weren't even expecting.
Megan Hawkins, Director of Community Engagement at the Lexington Humane Society. We thank you so much.
Thank you so much. We love to talk about everything we're doing, and we're just so grateful to have the support of everyone in the Lexington area.
One fellow dog lover we know used his own canine pal as the model for an important character in his latest novel. I'm talking about Lark Ascending and Kentucky Poet Laureate Silas House. Silas, I know you share your home with a fine individual who just happens to be a dog.
Yes.
Tell us about that individual.
Well, he's a beagle. He's 5 years old. His name is Ari Prince Rogers Nelson. He's named for a character in the Royal Tenenbaums and Prince, the singer. He's a quiet beagle, which people think is an oxymoron. He's just very loyal and always by my side. He's certainly always by my side when I'm riding. And he just, you know, he makes everything better. That's what I always think. He just makes it a more joyful place.
Well, you know, you have said that living with dogs makes us better people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's from a dog just being themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about that.
Well, I think, you know, if you just look to dogs, they provide a lot of examples for us, especially the way that their only criteria for liking someone is if someone is nice to them. They don't care about skin color or orientation or religion or where you grew up or anything else. It's just about if you have some love in you and you're showing it to them, then they'll love you back. And I just think there's just not a better example of how we could be as people.
Why do you think it's appropriate, maybe even necessary, when writing or talking about dogs to be generous in the use of the word love, maybe more generous than you might normally be?
Well, for me, they just embody love. Now, with that said, I know some people are scared of dogs and have had bad experiences with dogs. But I think for the most part, some dogs are taught to be mean or they're pushed to be mean. But I think on the whole, they just embody love. And the dogs in my life, and I've had a dog my entire life. I've never not had a dog. I have always just epitomized love for me. You know, they're always happy to see you when you come home, and they're sad to see you go, and they'll snuggle up next to you. And for me, my concept of the God of my understanding is about love. So I always say that dogs, to me, are the closest personification of the divine that I've come into contact with. I think anyone who's been around a dog can tell that they get embarrassed, they get jealous, you know, they get ashamed, they want to be petted, they want to comfort you. I mean, those things are just clear. That's not a sign in human traits to them. And so, to me, there's a lot more going on there, you know, than we think.
Well, your novel, Lark Ascending, takes us into the mind and the thoughts of an unlikely secondary protagonist, and that's the beagle named Seamus. And in naming Seamus, you're paying homage to the late Irish poet Seamus Heaney, who had a gift of saying something extraordinary while he conveyed kind of a sense that this is something an ordinary person might actually say. In the novel, is Seamus the beagle channeling Seamus the poet?
Well, first of all, that's a beautiful way of articulating what Seamus Heaney did. And yes, I wanted him to embody qualities of Seamus Heaney, and especially the way the Irish people loved Seamus Heaney. I mean, when he died, it was such a public mourning, you know, and people were grieving so openly. So he came to transcend poetry. And to my mind, Seamus in the book is also a symbol for Ireland. And so it's all tangled up together. Seamus also allows us sometimes to know things that our narrator does not, because he overhears other people talking and he sees things, he senses things. So that puts the reader a little ahead of the narrator. And that's a cool device as well. But, you know, when you think about Seamus Heaney, what made him a great poet was his great empathy. And I think that the dog, Seamus, exhibits love, empathy in the book as well, the way that he comforts people and the way he's grieving for the loss of his first person, who was his whole world. And that's another thing. Anybody who's been around a dog, you know, that's lost another person or animal in the house, the dog grieves. I've witnessed my own dogs doing that.
And in the novel, he's coming out of that grief into an encounter with Lark, the protagonist in the book. And initially, as there would be, there's a need to establish trust.
Yes.
Is that part of Seamus's role to convey what it means to trust another?
Yes. I mean, this is a survival story. It's an adventure story. And I find that a lot of times, especially in sort of apocalyptic situations, it's accepted for a main character to just lay down their humanity and just, you know, plow down anybody who's in their way. And my character, Lark, one thing I really wanted him to do was he really wants to hold on to his humanity in his survival. And I think that the dog helps him to do that and reminds him that he can survive and also be a good person.
You've said that Seamus opened the door for Lark to live again. How does that happen?
Well, when Lark meets Seamus, he's lost everything. He's lost everybody he's ever known. He's lost his own country. He's a refugee. And the first creature he encounters is Seamus. And he is able to establish that trust. They recognize that they are both grieving. They recognize that in each other. They're both trying to survive. And so they provide a lot of things for each other that he can't necessarily do when he meets a human. It takes him a long time because he's been betrayed and he's seen so much terrible behavior from humans that he can't trust them as easily as he can this animal.
Well, you've written then that when dogs offer themselves up to receive adulation, and I think most dog owners have experienced that, that when they do this, they cause us to become still. They cause you to become still, and that this moment is what life is all about. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, I think so often, you know, we're running off to work, or we have this responsibility or that responsibility, and, you know, it makes it much harder for me to get up and leave when that little dog is standing there whining after me, and I'm not so eager to leave the house. It sometimes becomes a problem that, you know, every party we go to, our standard line is we have to get home to the dog, and it's not just an exit strategy. We really want to get home to the dog. And so I do think that they cause me to be still more often and to slow down, to, you know, sit down and just pet them and sort of have a conversation in that shared adulation. It makes you feel better. I mean, it's been scientifically proven that petting the dog reduces your heart rate or your blood pressure or something like that. And, you know, that reduces stress.
You've also written that you believe a sort of holiness is required to remind us that everything in this world deserves affection, and that dogs know this. As you put it, they know and know and know. Mm-hmm. Yet they never judge. What's the lesson there?
Well, the lesson for me is to judge less. You know, I think as a human, one of our defaults is to jump to judgment. Some of that is a survival technique that's in our DNA. And so, you know, in that regard, dogs will judge a situation, et cetera. But when I say that, I mean, like I said earlier, they're not judging based on sort of the things society judges so many people on, like race, gender, orientation, religion, locale, you know, things like that. So they just constantly remind me of that.
Silas House, Kentucky Poet Laureate and author of Lark Ascending. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up there for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.